I'd like to call the meeting to order, and we will at least begin listening to testimony, even though we don't have quorum, so we can't take any official action at this point. But, on House File, I'd like to move House File 3612, Representative Dills, or Chair Dills' bill, on youth hunting requirements. Mr. Bogus, if you are ready to begin your comments, we'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. And the contents of House File 3612 are very similar. In fact, most of them are identical to what the department had initially proposed for youth hunter simplification. Put together a work group or task force to look at this issue a year ago, and I have with me Jay Johnson, who's our hunter recruitment retention coordinator for hunting and fishing, and Jay would like to take a few minutes to quickly walk through a PowerPoint presentation that describes the work group that we put together and their general recommendations. And then if you want to talk specifically about the bill, we can do that, Madam Chair, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Bogus. Mr. Jorgensen, or Johnson, excuse me, if you'd like to state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jay Johnson. I'm the Hunter Recruitment and Retention Coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And as Ed said, that I just want to kind of walk you through a simple PowerPoint that'll basically give you a better understanding of what we're looking at here in terms of youth regulation simplification. And to start with, the reason we're looking at simplifying youth hunting regulations is that regulatory barriers, complex regulations, costs related to participation in hunting, all these can lead to constraints and real barriers for parents and guardians who are interested in getting their youth involved in hunting. And as an agency, we have an interest in maintaining or increasing outdoor recreation participation, and hunting is one of the major outdoor recreation participation types for citizens of the state of Minnesota. So we're interested in trying to do whatever we can to keep folks hunting and particularly introduce new kids to hunting. So we came to this work based on the types of questions that our conservation officers in the enforcement division field on an annual basis during and pre to the hunting season, and also our information center, and also ourselves in the Division of Fish and Wildlife. We have parents calling us on a regular basis, very confused about what they need to do to take their son or daughter or their grandson or granddaughter hunting. That, along with some discussions that we had with Representative Dill at previous roundtable meetings and other stakeholders, we finally decided it's time to do something about it. So this last year, we put together the Youth Simplification Committee. And with that, I'll start the presentation. The committee was made up of a broad group of stakeholders, representatives from various groups that represent sportsmen across the state. And you can see the list there. We have one of the members here with us today, Mr. Tom Glines from the National Wild Turkey Federation. But we went out and contacted the major hunting organizations who have the largest membership bases in terms of their interest in hunting, and got people from those groups to sit on the committee in an effort to try to get as broad and well-rounded of a set of recommendations for youth regulation simplification as we could get. So here's their charge. Basically, they were asked to make recommendations for how the DNR might simplify regulations to make them more user-friendly, consistent, easier to interpret, with the goal of reducing barriers to youth participation in hunting and improving the quality of experience for all people involved. Pretty broad goal, but intuitively a pretty simple thing. We met, we had two meetings with the group that were facilitated by Kathy Don Carlos from our agency. They debated back and forth. They first looked at regulations from surrounding states. They looked at existing regulations here in Minnesota. They queried us with questions about participation rates for the various hunting disciplines for youth, debated back and forth, came to us with a series of recommendations from those debates. And those recommendations were remove minimum age requirements for hunting. And just for some background context, we currently, under existing statute, do not have a minimum age for youth to hunt small game. And in 2005, I believe, the minimum age to hunt wild turkeys was reduced. So the only minimum age to hunt right now that we currently have are for big game. That'd be archery deer, firearms deer, you know, firearms black bear, so on and so forth. And so these recommendations remove all minimum ages, making that consistent across all hunting types. It standardizes the age when hunter education, firearm safety is required. There's a lot of confusion amongst folks. For instance, hunter education, firearm safety isn't required till age 13, but if you want to hunt white-tailed deer with firearms, you've got to have it at age 12. Wasn't really any consistency to when that was required, and the recommendations from this committee standardize that age when it is required. They standardize the regulations for youth across all species. In the past, you could hunt turkeys when you were 7 years old and you needed a license, but you didn't need a license to hunt small game until you were 16 years old, yet you could hunt them at any age also. So there was a lot of confusion as when I can start hunting, what I have to have. As a parent, these recommendations really simplify that. The recommendations from the committee were to try to enhance and clarify the definition of accompaniment, and that is both from the standpoint of the user, the parent, and also from the standpoint of our agency and the conservation officer in trying to interpret and enforce those definitions. And finally, the fifth and kind of the major ones, it provided a reduction in the license fee for the majority of the youth hunters there. Currently, under current licensing, we have about 76,000 youth hunters. And under their recommendations, we would license an additional probably 23 or 24,000 youth hunters. Those new ones would have to pay a license fee when they don't currently now, but the 76,000 that are currently paying the youth license fee, their fees would be pretty dramatically reduced. Okay. Now, some other recommendations that came out of this that were sort of important but not as important as those top five were by changing to the recommendations of the committee put forward, it allowed the state to capture additional Pittman-Robertson funds for wildlife programs, wildlife management within the state. It provides a mechanism to track participation data for all youth hunters. It provides an opportunity to educate and underscore that there is a value to wildlife by licensing all hunters. Provides opportunity to involve youth in the licensing process from the early age. That kind of goes hand in hand with number eight. And it provides an opportunity to draw attention to the fact that you can hunt before completing firearms safety hunter education. There was a lot of perceived confusion amongst the public and also confirmed by our committee members, especially our COs who are out in the field, that said that they would often run into people that had no idea that they could have been hunting with their youth, small game, grouse, pheasants, so on and so forth, before the age of 12 when they were required to have firearm safety. So, if what we did is we took those recommendations, looked at existing statute, and incorporated them into a package of what the youth regulations would look like, and that is this slide right here. And I think you've all got that in your handout. And it basically just illustrates exactly what I went through. So the way it is set up under current proposal is that age 12 and under, I don't have to explain this, you can see this directly on your sheet, but same price fee from the time you start hunting until you turn an adult at age 18. So 17 and under, the fee would be $2.50. Okay? Firearm safety would be required for ages 13 and under. Youth must be accompanied until they're 13 years old. A license is required for all species type when you start hunting. Okay. So basically, what this does is it makes it very consistent that when you turn 13, you've got to have your firearm safety. When you start buying a license from the day that you start hunting, so there's no question on what's, you know, one species you buy a license, one species you don't. And the fee stays the same until you turn an adult. Okay? Anticipated results of those recommendations, if they were adopted, we'd have across-the-board consistency on all youth regulations. They'd be much easier for folks to understand and follow. There'd be reduction in regulatory complexity and fiscal barriers related to youth hunting. And there'd be a better, we'd be able to get a better understanding of youth participation trends because we would be licensing youth from the time that they did start hunting. And with that, I would answer any questions from the Madam Chair or the members.
Are there any questions for members? Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one thing I want to bring up. I've had a lot of conversations with a constituent up north about a youth non-resident trapping, something we don't have. And he has some grandchildren in Wisconsin that come over. And, you know, can we address that in these regulations?
Madam Chair and Representative Murdoch, the committee did not address trapping. That wasn't something that we were asked to address, so I can't speak to that right at this moment. I guess, Ed?
Madam Chair and Representative Murdoch, the current law only allows trapping by residents except for a person that owns land in the state can get a non-resident trapping license to trap on their own land, and it's been a point of some controversy within the Trappers Association where some members of the association have wanted Minnesota to open up for non-resident trapping to so they could trap in other states that have reciprocity that won't allow Minnesota residents to trap. But I don't know that the idea of a youth trapping has ever really been discussed, so I think that's a kind of a new idea that wouldn't be allowed by current law, but we haven't really talk to the trappers about it or even talked among ourselves about it to this point. So,
okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Murdoch.
So from what you're saying is we don't have a out-of-state adult trapping then either, correct?
Mr.
Madam
Boggs.
Chair, Representative Murdoch, no, we do not unless you own land in the state and then you can get a license to trap on your own land, unless you're a non-resident who owns land in the state. So the general rule is no non-resident trapping at all.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and maybe this was covered earlier when I wasn't able to be here, but what was the fiscal impact of these license fee changes?
Go ahead.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, it's estimated to be somewhere between about $500,000 to $550,000 reduction.
Representative Hansen, did you have a follow-up?
Well, Madam Chair, and just a comment that we continue to make exemptions and changes, and they all have an impact, all have a fiscal impact. You know, I think there's a value in having, I don't think the barrier's money, I think the barrier's time. I think with youth hunting, it's time rather than money. And I think there's a value in developing that conservation ethic with people realizing that their game and fish dollars, their license fees, go towards the resource that they're using. And having that done at an early age instills that. And so a $500,000 hit is not small change. And I just think that we keep making policy changes here that have financial consequences and may not have the societal result that we think they will.
Mr. Boggess.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, we've certainly been hearing that, and the fee that's in here is the minimum fee that would qualify a person buying one of these licenses to be counted as a licensed hunter in Minnesota and capture the federal aid. And that was one of the things that this work group had recommended, is that that we do charge a fee that they would count as a licensed hunter for purposes of apportionment of the federal aid. But we've already started looking at some other options. This was in keeping really with what the work group had recommended, but we're starting to look at some other options that would make this at least closer to revenue neutral. That wasn't the way we initially proposed it, but we hear the concern, and we share that concern in these economic times.
Mr. Johnson, oh, I have a question here, and then I think Representative McNamara does. I'm just wondering, could you please clarify? I may have misunderstood. We were saying that the 13 and under are not required to take the firearms training. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, current statute is that firearms safety, hunter education training is required at age 13, except if you hunt big game, then it's required at age 12.
Thank you. And the new regulation as proposed would be?
We would change it so that all hunting types, it would be required at age 13, rather than 12 for big game, firearms, and 13 for other types now. It would just make it consistent at one age.
Hmm. I'm just wondering, how many of those 4 and 5-year-olds do you think are going to be able to kind of get much out of this? What do you anticipate for 4 and 5 and 6 and 7-year-olds going out hunting? Do you have any figures that you've heard a groundswell of people that want, you know, no minimum? And how young are these hunters going to be?
Madam Chair, the only license type that we have where we can look in the state to see what participation rates we're getting from the youngest youth is our turkey license that went through in 2005, which required a license for all kids no matter when they start hunting. When you look at those rates, really license sales don't kick in terms of any real numbers till you get to be about 8 or 9 years old. So there's very few people under 8 or 9 that are actually participating in hunting.
And just to follow up along that line, I'm just wondering, what have you heard from groups other than hunting and fishing about no minimum age for children going hunting? Have you heard from any other groups? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, I have not heard from any other groups on that.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of questions. Mr. Bogus, does the $500,000 hit to the fund, does that take into account the Pittman-Robinson money that will come in?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, it does. It would raise about $200,000 roughly of additional Pittman-Robinson, but the actual loss in revenue compared to current licensing would be about $700,000, so that $500,000 is the difference.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bogus, do you know how many youth hunters there are for deer hunting, approximately?
I'll defer to Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson.
I estimated around 60,000.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So I just think the department want to think along Representative Hansen's lines. That would take an extra $5 for each of those $300,000. Would that then make it? That wouldn't even make it neutral yet. You got to get 500 to get there. So it would have to go to $10 or something to get. Okay. I think that that's worth looking into, that maybe the deer hunting might be one potentially that we should think about before we hit the fund for $500,000.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, just to be clear, the $2.50 proposed fee, the guidance from our committee was that we price this license at the lowest possible rate that we could and still capture those kids for federal aid. But in doing additional calculations, we get fairly close to revenue neutral when we get in the range of about $7.50 per license. And we've actually, as Deputy Commissioner Vargas said, we've looked at a couple of different options on how we might price this to get towards that revenue neutral.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The one thing I would say, I want it to be $250 for the small game and all that. I think we want to encourage that. But if you make a commitment to go deer hunting, I got to be honest, 250 to 750, there's some, a big part in deer hunting's a big thing. $5 isn't probably going to stop you from going deer hunting, but it could easily stop you from going out to go hunt rabbits or something would be my point. So just I think Representative Hansen's point is well made. Madam Chair, I'm wondering, you raised a question about youth hunt, and I'm wondering if Major Smith could answer a couple of questions that I'd like to ask about youth hunt and the real young hunting. Major, as you're coming up, if I'm not mistaken, don't your officers in the field have the right to ask a young hunter to demonstrate the ability to perform as a hunter? In other words, we had concern when a few years ago we allowed the turkey hunters to potentially, someone as the chair asked about a five-year-old hunting turkeys, you know, potentially they would get a license, the adult gets a license, now all of a sudden they can shoot two turkeys. But if the most five-year-olds, my business partner's son probably could shoot a 20-gauge maybe when he was six or seven, and turkey hunting would be one of the easiest game probably to shoot a 20-gauge at. Don't you have to demonstrate the ability to actually be able to shoot the gun, or you would not really, you'd be in trouble?
Major Smith.
Madam Chair, for the record, Major Rodman Smith, DNR Enforcement Operations Manager. Representative McNamara, as far as going out and finding a youngster in the field and making them demonstrate proficiency before, I'm not aware of any case where we've charged anybody or told a youngster you can't hunt. You know, we always tend to look at the extremes about a five-year-old. The majority of the people, youngsters we see, aren't really the five-year-olds. They're more the seven, eight, nine, ten-year-olds. To answer your question directly, Representative, I'm not aware of any cases, not saying that there have been, but I'm not aware of any cases where our officers have made somebody go through a proficiency. We do have something similar that you might be confusing it with just a little bit, and that's with ATVs, where they have to show that they fit the machine, that their arms can reach the brakes and their legs can reach the pedals, and that's that. We do have that written in, but I'm not aware of anything specific for actual hunting.
Representative McNamara.
Along the same lines, and I was thinking that we did pursue that, but I guess that would be really hard. But I would imagine it wouldn't be unusual for an officer to separate the adult and the juvenile and have a conversation about what actually happened or who actually took the game, if there was a question along those lines.
Madam Chair.
Major Smith.
Representative McNamara. You're getting into an area about when a juvenile is interviewed by law enforcement as far as a criminal investigation and the requirement of whether or not a parent needs to be there or the parent consents to the juvenile to talk to law enforcement. So as far as the separation, I guess I'd have to look at it more in a specific case. It's kind of hard to talk about generalities. Is that
Representative McNamara?
Well, then it sounds like it just comes down to parent responsibility is what you're saying. If the parent wants to try and cheat, they might have some options to cheat if they wanted to or deprive the child of the opportunity or whatever. But otherwise, you've mentioned a couple things that I wasn't sure. I thought that you might have to develop some proficiency, and you're saying it's problematic to go think you're going to jump in between a parent and a child. There's some legal concerns there. So thank you.
I guess I would have a question for you also, Mr. Smith. You mentioned, or Major Smith, you mentioned that it's usually, what, 8 or 9 year olds, kind of, seven, not a whole lot of 5 year olds. So why would you even propose to say it's all right for 5 year olds to go hunting? I'm just curious as to what motivated your thoughts in not developing this proposal, if it's generally speaking, you know, somebody that's seven or above.
Madam Chair, I wasn't on the work group, but we do have those instances where a five-year-old will go, And, you know, it's not as common, I guess, as you would say, but, you know, where do you draw that line? And there are some five-year-olds that can handle a 20-gauge shotgun or a 22 rifle. There's some 7-8-year-olds that can't. I mean, kids are different sizes. They have different abilities. They're, you know, at that age. And I think it's hard to draw a line in the sand, and maybe Mr. Johnson can maybe talk to that a little bit better, but that's just my perspective.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, speaking on behalf of the committee, and these discussions did take place in earnest at the committee level, their feeling is that their goal was to try to make licensing consistent, standardized. We currently do not have minimum age requirements for small game or for wild turkey, and in their efforts to make them consistent and make it standardized, they felt that with that in place already as a context, that the parent should be the one that is responsible for deciding when their youth should start hunting.
Are there any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and on this particular issue, I think that the last time I looked at numbers, and it's been a few years since we changed it on the turkey, but that there were people who were getting licenses that were 1 year old or 2 years old or 3 years old. There were some. Mm-hmm. Not zero, but some. I had a birthday party a couple weeks ago with my son, who is five years old. It's not his birthday yet, but there was a five-year-old, a three-year-old, and an 18-month-old. I looked at those three kids there, and not a one of them could lift a gun. And not a one of them should be. And I think we're going to have to revisit this because if somebody's applying for a license for a one-year-old, Major Smith, you're not going to be able to interview that one-year-old, or I'd like to be there when you do, because it's not going to be, it's not real. they're not out there applying. So I understand the intent and I understand the need, but I don't want three-year-olds out there saying they're licensed. They could be sitting next to you, and they could learn. I brought my five-year-old out hunting, but we gave him a stick, not a gun. And I think we're playing with fire here, either on the cheating side of people who are getting a free license and saying it's their two-year-old that's actually out there hunting, or you're having someone out there who cannot comprehend, 4 years old, cannot comprehend what that end of that gun means. I understand the intent, it's valuable, but I think if you look through the data and if you could provide the data to the committees over the last few years, there are people who are getting turkey licenses that are 2 years old or 3 years old.
And I guess I would just like to add as well that, you know, it would be one thing if we were actually making $500,000 on this instead of potentially losing it, but I think this question still remains, you know, is that worth the trade-off of having the potential very young children, and what does that say? And I guess I always think about the times when we have the 60-minute bills that come before us with regard to, I call them that, regard to some problem, some situation that went awry, and then the entire state becomes very concerned about that issue. And then we pass a law that can't happen anymore. I just would like to encourage to review a little bit of common sense about ages. I certainly can see the sense about standardizing some of the costs, and I can understand how people are confused about who can be involved with hunting what at what time, and there's a lot of opportunity for some standardization that would be helpful, but since we're going to just lay this bill over, I would hope that the committee, not this committee, but the one that came up with the recommendations, and you folks could kind of review a little bit about the age. I think that might be something useful. Are there any other additional questions? Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, I just from an information standpoint, one thing to just remember is that we currently have no minimum age for small game. We have no minimum age for turkey hunting as it stands right now in statute. So those did not change in these series of recommendations. And the other thing to keep in mind is when you look at incident re- reports, that's firearms-related incident reports, hunting-type incidents. Always, when you look at those reports, supervised youth hunters have the lowest incident rates of any category. So there is some data available both on a state and national basis on this matter.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you for your testimony. I will hear House File. I will move House File 3612. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I thought there was another one. We will, at this point, be looking at a presentation on Timberwolf Management. Again, Mr. Bogus or Dan Stark apparently will be giving some
Thank
testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While Mr. Stark is getting his presentation queued up, just let you know that there's been a long history of wolf management in the state that began with statehood or before, actually, but federal protections for wolves came in 35 or 40 years ago, and we were asked just to give there's been a lot of concern with kind of federal status, state status, that the status has gone back and forth between federally listed or delisted and under state management, then back federally listed, and it's been a little bit of a back and forth over the last few years. So our purpose here is just to take about 20 minutes or so just to brief the committee on kind of the history and status of timberwolves in the state and their management, both through federal protection and proposed and at least briefly in place state management. So Dan Stark is in our wildlife section and is our wolf and bear specialist, and with that I'll let him do the presentation.
Welcome to committee, Mr. Stark. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Stark. I'm the wolf specialist for the Minnesota DNR. I'm just going to give a overview of wolf management in Minnesota and basically talk about the recovery of the wolf population, the current population status, and both the management of wolves under federal management and what the differences are or what the differences will be once they're delisted under state management. Basically, wolves were unprotected in Minnesota until the early 70s when the Endangered Species Act was passed, and in 1974 wolves were listed under the Endangered Species Act as endangered species. At the time, the only known wolf population in the lower 48 states was in northern Minnesota and on Isle Royale and Lake Superior. Approximately 700 to 1,000 wolves were estimated to be in Minnesota at the time. Currently, there's three populations of wolves in the lower 48 states, including wolves in the Great Lakes region of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, the wolf population in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, and then a endangered subspecies, the Mexican gray wolf, in the southwestern U.S. All these are recovery programs under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The area that has been focused on by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in this region was classified or called the Western Great Lakes Distinct Population Segment. And this area, identified in the light blue shaded region, was delisted in March of 2007. It was removed from the federal list of endangered species. That proposal was challenged, and the decision was reversed in court, and the wolves went back on the list in September of 2008. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service addressed the court ruling with a new proposal that delisted wolves in the spring of 2009, only to have it overturned again by a court decision a few months later. So currently, wolves are classified as threatened in Minnesota. There are five management zones, and basically, the only difference among these zones is there's some federal requirement for consultation on federal development in zones 2 and 3. And in zone 1, there's a restriction that wolves can't be taken for depredation control where there's damage caused to domestic animals. But in the remainder of the state, wolves can be trapped and removed where damage is verified by a conservation officer or USDA Wildlife Services agent. Minnesota first conducted a systematic survey of their wolf population in 1978, and we've conducted periodic surveys since that time, at first at 10-year intervals and more recently at 5-year intervals. And this survey method combines both observations of wolves by natural resource personnel and detailed information about radio-collared wolves. We want to know information about average pack size and average territory size. It also incorporates estimates of road density and human density to model the state based on what's published in the literature about whether wolves will tolerate certain road densities, how many wolves will exist in those areas. And then we add an estimate of the percent of the population that's lone wolves and include an estimate for pack buffers, such as the area that's illustrated down in the lower left corner, because these areas don't always line up perfectly. So as an example, the map shows the areas in yellow that are modeled as either townships where wolves were observed based on their sign, an observation of a wolf, or an area that would satisfy a minimum road density of 0.7 kilometers per square kilometer or a human population density of less than 4 people per square kilometer. And so there are some holes within that total wolf range that we estimate, or kind of a coarse distribution of where wolves occur, the outer boundary there with a dark black line. So just a run through of these surveys, in 1978 we estimated about 1,235 wolves, the red area on the map. By the late 80s, that population had expanded, the green portion of the map, about 1,500 to 1,750 wolves. And then by 1998, we basically reached our current wolf distribution. The population was estimated at almost 2,500 wolves. And we've had two surveys since then, in 2003 and 2004, and then again in 2007, 2008. And essentially, the population remained unchanged at about 3,000 wolves. Estimate of about 500 packs, average pack size of about 5 wolves in each pack, covering a 40 square mile area. So currently, it appears that all the suitable areas in the state have been occupied for at least 10 years, and we have a population that will probably fluctuate somewhere around 3,000 wolves. And with that number of wolves, we have a certain number of conflicts with humans. One of the most closely managed issues is with livestock depredation. And this is just an example of all the verified wolf complaints in the state. They're pretty evenly distributed throughout the wolf range. Primarily, these complaints are with cattle, about 72%. 14% of those complaints were dogs, 7% sheep, and then 7% other. These included horses, pigs, and goats, other things that we don't have a category for. The peak of the depredation season occurs in the summer months when wolves are out on pasture, usually on larger pastures away from barns, and there's less human activity. So we see a spike in the depredation complaints each year in the summer months. Over time, the number of complaints tracks pretty closely with the number of, or the total number of complaints tracks pretty closely with those that are verified, but usually there's twice as many complaints as there are verified incidents. In 2009, there were over 200 complaints, and 95 of those were verified at about 80 farms. And on average, over the last 10 years, you see about 160 complaints, 80 of which are verified at 70 farms. In response to those livestock depredations, the USDA Wildlife Services Agency traps and either captures or kills the wolves. Primarily, they're euthanized, but under the federal wolf rules, pups that are caught before August 1st have to be released on site. So that's the difference between wolves that are captured and killed, basically. Over the last 10 years, on average, we have about 135 wolves that are killed in response to livestock depredations. In 2009, there were 195 wolves that were killed. So we saw an increase in 2009. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture compensates verified losses caused by wolves to livestock. This is looking at those claims from about 1993 to November of 2009. This is based on the fiscal year that those claims are paid. We see an average here of about 70 complaints or 70 claims each year and about $74,000. For 2008, we had $95,000 that was paid in claims. In 2009, there were $88,000. And for fiscal year 2010, there's already been $85,000 paid in claims. And as you're aware, this amount is $75,000 is appropriated by the legislature for this program. So we've exceeded those claims. There is some money available in the elk claims where if that money is available in the elk appropriation, wolf compensation claims can be paid. But we've exceeded the $75,000 amount for the last 3 years, and it's averaging about $74,000. Just a little bit of quick information about wolves and white-tailed deer, because this is a pretty hot topic in Minnesota. A lot of people have an interest in what are the impacts on deer that are caused by wolves. And based on a radio-colored study in north central Minnesota that the DNR did, it was a long-term study, covered 15 years, and radio-colored 450 female deer during that time, and also had 55 wolves collared. And based on that study, they saw an average annual mortality rate on the deer population of about 10%. And if you applied that statewide, it'd be about 45,000 to 600,000 deer are killed by wolves each year. This is based primarily on some severe winters, though, where wolves have a better time at killing deer because they're nutritionally stressed and are just more vulnerable to predation. In addition to that, deer fawns are susceptible to predation, but it's not just wolves. 50% of the mortality caused to fawns is caused by bears, bobcats, and coyotes as well. This has been documented in additional research studies. But the one thing about deer is they have a very strong population response to wolves and the ability to rebound from those numbers. On average, the population is about 5 to 7 years old, and 13% of the population can be 10.5 to 18.5. They have high pregnancy rates. Yearling does is as high as 90%, and other does up to age 15 as high as 95% pregnancy rates. So we basically see about a 35% annual recruitment, even with wolf predation. Wolves do have a hard time killing deer. There's a pretty low predation success. About 10% of the attempts, they're successful at killing white-tailed deer. And even though they are killing deer, sometimes this is compensatory mortality, where these deer, during severe winters, are already vulnerable to predation. And so they're basically near death anyway, and wolves take advantage of that. There's also a pretty strong population cycle response that we expect. We're not going to have a lot of wolves without a lot of deer. And so when deer numbers are high and start to drop a bit, wolves are probably going to respond to that. There will likely be a lag period. In 1998, the DNR adopted a wolf position statement, which basically says that we'll ensure the long-term survival of the wolf and resolve conflicts between wolves and humans. And so with that position statement, they initiated a wolf plan or a wolf management plan planning process, which basically incorporated a lot of public input through public information meetings, a citizen roundtable that was to meet and provide consensus recommendations on difficult management issues with wolves. It basically keeps in place a lot of the current wolf management activities and also enhances or adds others. It addressed wolf conservation concerns about population status, enforcement, compensation for depredation, administrative issues, and staffing. Kind of the two key components of this plan include population management. There's basically no numerical restraints on the population numbers or where they occur in the state. There is a minimum population goal of at least 1,600 wolves that would trigger a response by the DNR to try to maintain that number or reverse whatever trend is causing that decline in the population as quickly as possible. And there'd be no public taking for at least 5 years, which was established by the legislature in 2000. The wolf depredation management program would pretty much track with how it currently stands, with DNR enforcement verifying claims along with Wildlife Services doing some of the depredation work. We also initiated a state-certified predator control program, and this program was implemented when wolves were delisted. We trained about 20 state-certified controllers that would be able to go out and respond to depredations or proactively trap in certain areas of the state based on historic depredations. The depredation compensation program would continue, and two wolf zones are established, Wolf Zone A and B. Zone A is traditionally kind of the core wolf population. There's more protections for wolves in that area of the state. It's about 30,000 square miles of northeastern Minnesota, and then Zone B is the remainder of the state. In Zone A, individuals can shoot a wolf if there's an immediate threat to their livestock or domestic animals. And an immediate threat is a wolf that is stalking, attacking, or killing their pet or livestock. In Zone B, there doesn't need to be an immediate threat. People can shoot a wolf on their land that's owned, managed, or leased in defense of livestock or pets. And this is the wolf management zones A and B in green and blue, with the wolf distribution in orange. And it just gives you an idea of where those wolves are in relation to the two wolf zones. Probably about 500 wolves occur outside of Zone A in that portion of the state identified as Zone B. And a quick comparison of the difference between federal wolf status and state wolf management. The legal status for wolves under the Endangered Species Act is they're currently threatened. In Minnesota, under state law, they'd be a protected wild animal with no open season. The population goals for recovery in Minnesota were 1,251 to 1,400 wolves, a number that we probably reached by the late 80s. And the state plan, there's a minimum population, but there's no maximum population. The zones we've gone through, there's five zones under federal management and two under state. To get into some of the details as far as taking wolves, there is an allowance for taking wolves in defense of human life under the Endangered Species Act. That's true also under state management, but there's also provisions that we talked about for protecting livestock and pets and the potential for a harvest 5 years post delisting. And then depredation control, currently it's only done under government agents, but would be allowed by state certified predator controllers, and then also private individuals have the flexibility to take wolves as well. And that's all I have for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. I believe Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the compensation livestock depredation compensation. Is that general fund, the funding source?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanson.
Mr. Stark.
Yes, I believe that is from the general fund. It's appropriated to the Department of Ag, and they pay it through the Department of, it's a Department of Ag program.
Representative Purcell.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. You'd mentioned about 45,000 deer killed by wolves a year, an estimate. What's the wolf population at this time? I'm looking at just trying to crunch a number here. Deer per wolf per year.
Mr. Stark.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, the estimate for each wolf kills about 15 to 20 deer per year. So with a population of about 3,000 wolves, it's somewhere between 45,000 and 60,000 deer.
Thank you.
And we estimate the forest deer population is about 450,000 deer within that, kind of that same wolf range.
And Madam Chair, and what's the average human take on deer each year? Do you have that number?
Mr. Stark.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, it's about $100,000, 100,000 deer in the forested part of the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stark, do you know, would we be able to activate or Mr. Bogus the 5 years after the delisting? I think we had a question earlier in the year. I'm wondering if you ever found any information out. We've been delisted, I believe, twice already, but it's gone back. Would the 5 years be able to start as far as the season 5 year post delisting?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the delisting rule that was proposed or was put in place was reversed due to litigation. So basically, it was determined that you know, we reset the clock when there's a new delisting rule.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And who made that determination?
Well, I think it was just based on discussions that we had in the DNR, because the delisting was challenged, the decision was reversed, and because of that legal decision, the delisting basically didn't occur. You know, it was found that it was illegal to delist wolves.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I think it's somewhat of an open question, because the five-year waiting period, if you will, is a state statute. There's nothing in federal rule that governs that, but there is a federal post-delisting monitoring period that's 5 years, during which time, and Mr. Stark can correct me if I'm wrong, but during which time the federal government can, through a very expedited process, relist wolves if they deem that it's necessary, without having to go back to kind of square one of the listing process. So, but you know, the 5 years is in Minnesota law, it's not in federal rule.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. We do have a couple, we have to approve the minutes. Is there a motion? Representative Murdoch moves to approve the meeting minutes from March 8th. All those in favor say aye.
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 Minutes are approved. Anything else? Meeting adjourned.